Welcome, everybody, to another exciting and very special episode of Outside the Panels. I am at Chaz Simons. I'm joined, of course, by at PoetAir33, our marvelous producer, Jack, at Synesthetics, with the underscore and the X at the end. And most importantly, we're joined by Brian Wickman. That's right, the main man himself of Grit Fame, who we spoke about on one of our very first episodes. So we're very excited that you're here to talk about a book that we all enjoy, that Jack and I read for the first time just recently, but Michael has raved about. And I've heard, Brian, that when we mentioned we were doing this one, you were very excited, wanted to hop on it. So let's talk about Coffin Bound.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're very grateful for you coming on and to talk about this book. Yeah, Coffin Bound, which is a book by Dan Waters, who I'm obsessed with, all those white noise guys. I'm really into all the stuff they're doing. It reminds me of old school Vertigo, and it reminds me of like Neil Gaiman, old school Grant Morrison stuff, which really kind of all of their work.
Yeah, that initial Vertigo wave was 100% the like vibe that I picked up from the whole series, but definitely from like issue one, I felt like this should have been published in 1994 under that Vertigo imprint.
It would have been a classic now. I mean, Everyone would be talking about it.
I mean, it is a classic now, right? Arguably. It could be a cult classic before classic.
Fingers crossed hardcover comes out collecting the whole series. But it's written by Dan Waters, drawn by Danny, colored by Brad Simpson, lettered by, of course, Aditya Bidikar, who we've talked about in almost every episode of our series so far. And graphic designer is Emma Price.
Let's start with some initial overview thoughts. Brian, you want to open it up? Tell us what you love about this book. What's got you so hyped? Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to. I think that Dan and Danny are like the perfect match to create what I consider like an essential punk rock comic. I think that the punk aesthetic in comics often leans too hard on like leather jackets and spikes and not a general vibe. And this book, the whole vibe is just like this perfect counterculture weirdness. And it's, man, it's one of my favorite books of the last couple of years.
Mine as well. Yeah.
I got to agree with you on that punk going full leather and spikes, like almost all the time. That's the trope that they lean on heaviest. But this book, I got to say, is super punk rock without too much leather at all. In fact, most of the characters I feel like are kind of stripped down almost that we follow, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely in more ways than one.
Beyond skin.
In a lot of ways. Yeah.
We go, we usually try to go as much as we want, but try to not reveal the main endings.
Yeah. I mean, how spoiler heavy do we go on this show?
It's really up to you. If you want to throw out the spoiler warning before a bigger plot point or whatever so that people can pause. I don't know that anybody listening is going to pause, but if they want to, at least it's there. But
yeah, I think usually we go over, we like try not to give away the really big plot points, but most everything's fair game. Yeah,
I mean, I think just like sticking with general vibe, though, you had mentioned this like stripped down, and like that's everything from plot to like Danny's art in certain places. I can't think of another book that pulls off just like three facial features in a panel looking as good as this
one
does.
And it's expressive, I would say, too. Like, even though it's just three, there's a wealth of emotion on all of them, you know? Yeah.
For sure. There's like an eyeball and a nose in a panel, and you know what it's trying to do.
There's no question about that guy's super happy, and then you pull back and he's stabbed, and you're like, oops. Maybe not.
I like your art kind of evolves into more abstract from the first volume. It's much more detailed, and then like kind of her later works that she had done, she got kind of more abstract, and the second volume is definitely more abstract with the art, which I kind of love that. Seventh issue art, and just the seventh issue in general, is probably my favorite issue I read all year. That issue is incredible, especially the two assassins that at first look like just circles on figures on their heads are just circles.
Spy versus spy.
Yeah, they look like spy versus spy, and then they become like actually old men that are detailed and everything.
Was that the black, white, and red issue?
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was striking. Crazy visual storytelling.
It was like I want to go back to it. It was like punk rock sliding doors.
Yes.
But we got to watch both. Yeah. And I thought it was a really good, an interesting way to view life overall. Well, this whole book, I think, is a very interesting way to look at life and the impact that we leave on the world and what it means to those around us, which is pretty cool for a book that also has a vulture right. in a cage head and a earth eating creature, man.
Yeah.
Earthworm person.
This is what's important about the way they tell the story is that I don't care that I don't understand any of that. Like, it doesn't matter to me that I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That tripped me up.
I had a hard time pinning down like a specific moral to the overall story, and like sometimes it was kind of hard to decipher exactly where the story was going.
I can take the whole series.
It has like a ton of different like meanings and questions it brings up about like mortality and
life. So what I thought was most interesting about the first volume especially is that every single storyline ties back to this idea of erasing oneself. Like, even the side plots tie to that same thing, because there's the fellow who is quite literally physically erasing himself from existence. And
her manager.
Right.
What does he manage?
Oh, I love it.
Evidently.
And just like by the right, by the end of that volume, it is a very stark difference to the individual you're introduced to in the beginning, in a very wacky way. But like, that also ties to the main quest, which is erasing her mark on the world. And then it gets into with, you know, the women who are like peeling their skin off. Like, all of that is this sort of shedding of identity in three different ways. And it's cool that they're all so different but saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Those degloving sequences were...
Yeah.
Whoa, so intense. I always think I'm ready for it, especially in a still medium like comics. Like, I could take this at my own pace. I could go fast through it if I want to. But... I was so caught up in the story and the way that they describe it, that you have to peel away, you have to find that pain in order to like peel away deeper and cleaner or whatever, was just like too entrancing that
I feel like the first volume is definitely about erasing yourself, and the second volume's like a poem about choosing the way you die, which is kind of reflected in the seventh issue and even the last issue of the series, with Dahl also choosing her fate when she could have ran or gone away, but she kind of just waits for Madame Entropy, who is our replacement to Earth Eater, who I like a lot too. That last page, not to give it away, but if there's never another issue of Coffin Mound, I'd be happy. I think it's kind of, because it's kind of Dan's, I think a lot of what he's saying is we're all Coffin Bound and everything ends, including the series, which, to kind of go ahead of what we're going to talk about, that the way he does the ending is so perfect, because it just, like life, it just gets cut away. It's not like a grandstanding thing. It's just gone.
I think that, yeah, in line with that, he makes all of this weirdness feel normal by the end of both volumes. Where, like, you mentioned those degloving sequences, and the first time you see it is painful, but when these characters pop up in volume two, it's normal to me by then.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm not even questioning that this exists anymore, because I'm so focused on where the next thing is going.
I think with the degloving, like the seeing it the first time with like an experienced dancer was like one thing, but then seeing like the girl being introduced to it for the first time was a whole different thing. Like, yeah, Taka, when she starts doing it. Yeah,
that's yeah.
Like, ooh.
Yeah, but that issue is really where I fell in love with Taka, and I'm really glad she was the heroine of the second volume, because that issue is really strong in her story. And kind of the way she's feeling, how Izzy treated her and Cassandra. You're kind of standing on her own.
Was that where you started to hate Polly Starlight?
You know, he's just such a scumbag, and still debatably James Franco.
His first appearance in the book to his last appearance in the book was such a ride for me, because when he first shows up, oh, we're going daring do to like save my muse, I can't believe that the Earth Eater's been set upon her, and then It's almost as though he put the hit out himself and forgot.
He's trying to stop it,
and he gets buried in the earth, and like even that conversation he has with his like henchman as he's digging him out, and he's like, "I want your candor," and then he gives it to him, and he's like, "Well, now I hate it. So we're at odds. Don't you see we're rivals now? I can't have this." And he reminded him
that he put the hit out. He was like, "You did it," and he just beats him to death because he reminded him.
Which is great for a villain, but it's such a weird path for him to take. But also because he's the embodiment of poetry in this world, or the self-described sort of poet laureate, I guess, or whatever, of this plane of existence that we occupy. He's got to do it. Got to be slave to those romantic or destructive impulses.
Well, yeah, there's the that kind of has to play into like the irony you see in poetry.
Yeah.
I feel like does his poetry tie into some like mystical power, or is it just that he's really into poetry?
These are the many great things that aren't fully explained. What I love about the book, like he has that skin and bandages that heal your skin, but there's not much explaining to it. Which I'm all like we were talking about yesterday, Blue and Green. I'm all about no explanation, so I could just think about it more. I don't know if we ever get a straight answer to how he has all these items that you would consider magical or special, but yeah. So for the listener, Polly has these special wraps that if you cut your skin off, as his strippers do, and kind of unglove themselves, your skin grows back once you put these bandages and wraps on. We aren't given too much of an explanation, unless I missed it. Did Brian or Chaz, did you catch an explanation?
No.
I didn't.
And it's kind of better that way, because then I got to wonder, is that why the person, the manager, is so confident in, well, if I cut down my skin area, then I won't be in contact with germs. But if I want to grow it back, I can.
I don't know if you can grow back your whole
body. Oh, yeah, no, probably. That's a lot more bandages than he had.
I loved the panel of him as just a brain with sunglasses and
in liquids set on.
Yeah. why would a brain be wearing sunglasses and a headset? It's great.
Just so we know that it's the same guy. He didn't get a replacement brain at the last minute.
Oh, no, it's totally style.
I'm thinking back on this question of him as a poet, and I think that one of the smart things is that we see no evidence of him actually being good at what he does. Like Polly claims to be this fantastic artist,
and he's
we
got see the right
zero
attitude.
Evidence.
He does
of
do
it,
that one whatsoever. Poem right at the end.
I don't think he does. Yeah. He completes.
Does he?
Oh, he starts it. I know he's working on it at the end. I'm gonna have to go.
I thought he was just musing, to be honest. I kind of thought it was one of those.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I always figured Polly would be like
it was
one of those
pretty,
poets.
But I wouldn't think he's
He's got the words, but he never puts them to paper. Yeah, I think it's right before Izzy comes back.
Yeah, I think it's the final issue.
Issue 4.
I know he's working on his poetry in issue 3.
They also never really explain the relevance of the masks.
I think I had to pull out issue 1. They actually name them in issue 1, and I think it's when someone wears it in the act of killing. So it's kind of a way to disconnect yourself from yourself when you're killing someone. That's why anytime anyone's wearing it, they're about to commit an act of murder. So they're not connected with themselves.
It's like a psychological thing.
Yeah, tool. Yeah, they name it too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why Taka takes it, I think.
Yeah, they're cool masks. I was just wondering, if there was anything more to them than meets the eye, but
I feel like it's when she grabs it and puts it in the car.
There is one
poem.
The actual first issue, because I am new dad, so I don't have too much time, but I tried to reread this all 5 a.m. this morning, and I got about an issue and a half in before before that was not going to happen. So
before
I was
entropy took effect.
Entropy, kind of the opposite of entropy.
Right.
New Light was cuddle me, and I was all right. It's in the beginning, though. I know that because I want to notate it because they did definitely call it something.
Even if he does have some poems in there, I think Brian's right that there's no real gauge of good or bad to his poetry. Just there's almost no real gauge between good and bad in this world as far as behavior goes. There's just action.
He's just a crazy bohemian fucked up dude.
Yeah.
I picture Polly as like maybe the coolest guy in his circle. Yeah.
There's no one there to tell him. That's the way I look at it. They're all just like, of course, boss. Right. You're the man.
Yeah. Well, he's paying them all to be there and be his friends too. Which
exactly. Yeah.
Kind of like they have to say he's okay. Did anyone else? So the first volume, for the listeners that may not know really, because we're kind of being abstract, what's going on is about Izzy Tyburn, who's decided she wants to basically die and erase herself from the world. And she meets, at the same time, she has a contract put in her life with the Earth Eater, who's chasing her. And the Earth Eater is this bombastic villain. Every time he comes on the panels, you see Earth Eater. And then usually a few paragraphs of complete nonsense, which is great. He's out to kill her as well. And she kind of is followed by this Vulture, who's kind of our co-character of the first volume. And for a little explanation we're talking about, we'll talk about the second volume a little more in a second. But in the first volume, I really thought that Vladimir was kind of their interpretation for God in that world. The homeless guy?
Okay.
Because he talks about all of his children and he's burning the photos. And then he only shows up again at the very end of the first volume without giving too much away. I mean, I might be completely wrong. Well, everything's kind of left to the reader's perception.
Either way,
showing
back up, I saw as like a metaphor for like the frivolity of her journey to erase herself.
Yeah, and then him at the train tracks too.
I kind of thought it was a statement that you can't ever really, despite everything that Izzy's done, and to draw parallels between her and her manager, almost like she's erased so much, like he has. So we get to see like a visual. This is how far she's erased her presence on this earth. Near the end, when she meets Vladimir again one more time, and he basically tells her, like, well, I went to the end of the tracks, but there's still so much more. So even when this thing's over, there's still going to be something out there. There's still going to be someone tied to you. Like, you can't ever truly erase yourself in the way that she was trying. So, like, giving her that closure of knowing, like, she's done all that she can, but if this is her time, it's at least she knows it wasn't
like
for
you
not.
Leave an impact on others.
Yeah.
So you can't really erase yourself because you've already interacted in other people's lives as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember, like, early, before you get to the end with him, because he's, all, like, burning all the photos
about his
earlier,
children.
Right?
Yeah, that's the one thing that always catches me off every time I
and
read
about
it.
And about that, he won't be sad anymore because now he doesn't remember them. Once the photo's burned, he's going to forget them, and they turn into ashes, and then they're fine, presumably. But he still does, because he's talking about them.
Yeah. I imagine this sort of parallel journey he's taking in the background, where he's like sort of attempting the same thing as every other character in Volume 1, just in his own way. It's interesting that like every person is going about this in a different way.
We're all passively destroying ourselves in some way or another. Some
more
actively, I guess.
Physical, some more metaphorical.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that's a physical act of entropy, kind of the first volume, and then you have like a physical avatar of entropy in the second volume.
Yeah.
With entropy, I kind of think the main theme of the whole series.
I think it's also worth noting this series
is
really
peppered
funny.
With so much good humor.
Yeah, I got some good chuckles.
Like almost entirely self-referential in Volume 2, where it sort of makes fun of stuff that happened in Volume 1 really effectively. I am open to my favorite panel in, I think, the entire series, where Earth Eater is cutting a burger with a knife. and he's, like, looking as his doorbell rings, and it's that same, like, weird introduction. Earth Eater doesn't have a job due to start until next week and is enjoying some well-earned downtime. And, like, when you compare that to these, like, sort of like epic poetry introductions he got in Volume 1, like, what a good joke.
I even kind of thought Volume 1, like, the first two were serious for Earth Eater, right? He's the beast that can't be stopped. He listens to the hum of the planet. And then the third one would always be something like, and also he's kind of hungry right now. But but yeah, that one in particular is so good.
There's one that's like, yeah, it's difficult to like, watch.
Just like opening his mouth with dirt pouring down his chin.
Right.
But yeah, there's a lot of good humor in that too.
That he's concerned with Taka ruining the upholstery and that there's some sort of mud creatures or corpses at the table he's eating at, which I don't know what they were. Side note, we're just checking it out. We lost Jack.
Oh, he's back.
He's back.
I'm glad that somebody else saw that too, because I didn't. So when he's cutting the sandwich, the Himalayan soil sandwich, which was also very funny. there's like a family behind him that when he says reupholstered, like it's pretty gross.
I don't know if those are corpses or they're literally mud people, or I think they might be mud people.
I was kind of hoping that he was just trying to make a family, right? Because it's got to be lonely
with dirt.
Being the earth eater. Yeah. Like people only call when they need somebody dead, and then... People only see you when you're there
kind
to kill him.
He's a fucking weirdo.
But his look, that collar and cape, whew, that's a good look.
I think it's like in the first volume, I think I remember him wearing like a brown coat, and then in the second one, he's wearing like a white fur coat.
Yeah.
Which I think is a bold choice for somebody who eats dirt and kills people.
I think so. That's also, I thought, too, like, he's wearing the white one because he's got his downtime. So I know I'm not going to go get dirty. I'm just going to wear my white coat cape today. I'm just going to take it for a quick spin around the block.
I won't get my dirt burger on it.
Yeah. Definitely going to toss it over my shoulders.
Yeah, that's the first thing I thought of. So I was like, ooh, man, that white coat's got to get dirty.
But I like that Earth Eater is an entity and has arguably powers. Like, we were just talking about not knowing if Polly was really a poet, but we do get to see Earth Eater, he eats dirt, but anybody can do that, I guess. But he opens the ground up on several occasions and swallows people with it in a way that is so wild when it pops up. Like, when it happened at first, I was like, holy shit, how is Izzy ever going to get away from somebody that can do this? And then I realized, like, oh, well, that's kind of the point of Earth Eater, I guess, is that if we're all coffin-bound, we're all going to end up in the Earth at some point, eaten by Earth. So,
The Earth will swallow us all.
Yeah. But he is pretty, pretty great.
My final note on Earth Eater, I feel like that design is like a glam Cenobite from Hellraiser. which is exactly the vibe it should be, I think.
His character reminded me of like the guy from Raising Arizona, like the biker dude that follows him the whole time.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just kind of like mysterious and looking hardcore.
We have such soils to show you.
We haven't talked about Vulture much. Vulture's another great character that's created in the series.
Vulture,
sparsely.
I was gonna say I was very sad to see relegated to a like background role in the second volume as they search and quest for him. I was bummed because I really liked the little bit of like positivity brought to Izzy's journey. There's a thumbs up scene when I think it's she's on the phone with her manager talking about where she's going, and she's like, "Well, I'm heading this way, gonna die, gonna unlive." And he's like, "Are you alone?" And she's like, "I might as well be." But in the background, you see Vulture with his thumb up, like, "Way to go, guy! Whoever you're talking to, I'm proud of you." And visually, just super cool looking. You know, a bird skull and a cage head.
Yep.
Another Cenobite-esque idea.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think, like, what's under his clothes.
Is it a bird skeleton or a man skeleton?
Yeah, I guess that it's kind of question. I don't really know.
Is it just like a vulture's body
kinda,
wearing clothes?
He's kind of just like a vulture skeleton in a cage.
Well, you got a glimpse of his legs.
Okay, what do his legs look like? I missed that. Are they like human?
Wood. They're just like wood. Like almost like a puppet.
Like a wood puppet with a vulture head or something.
Yeah.
Par for the course.
Even though it's
trippy, man.
We were debating, but the second volume kind of disproves it. Jack was asking, who just finished it, if other people could see the vulture, which then we were debating, but then obviously we think they can because Taka-san, that's kind of what puts her on the journey in the second volume. But yep. Does anyone see him besides Taka?
It doesn't seem
I
like
think
it,
that only the individual dying. Who is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So does Taka only know about him because
so I guess anyone
was
could, but
about him, maybe? She didn't actually see him?
Or maybe she was already on her course to die, which has kind of made him visible to her.
She is very injured at the end of the first arc. Like so yeah. It could even be just a near-death experience that winked at her with that
open
vulture eye.
I was wondering with the vulture, it was like in the first volume, Izzy meets the vulture like long before, you know, her time. Or not long before, but, you know, they get to know each other. And then with the second issue, it seems like he doesn't appear until like the moment somebody's going to die. And, like, does he appear when anyone's going to die or just, like, in specific occasions?
It could just be that Izzy's quest to not die but to unlive was just so, like, interesting to him that he was like, I got to see, like, I know where this ends, but I need to watch.
I think they address that no one has ever survived the Earth Eater's hits. So I think there's a level of inevitability where, like, there's no way it could pan out but Izzy dying.
Okay.
Whereas with Taka, she is actively trying to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's kind of... That makes sense.
Oop, might need to repeat that one, Jack.
Oh, I just said that makes sense. Hello?
Right at the same time.
Am I... Am I cutting out?
A little bit.
Yes.
I thought maybe okay. It's just they didn't
just
want
said,
us to know.
All I said was that it makes sense.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The second volume, one of my favorite characters comes into it, and that's Tatter. I gotta love Tatter. I don't know. Tatter's a boxer who loves to lose and feel pain because it makes him know he's alive. And there's a lot of great symbolism and metaphors he brings up. And him and Taka's journey is really kind of sweet, and the only meet cute we get in all of Coffin Bound.
Well, don't discount Izzy and the Vulture. That's a pretty good meet cute. They kill some guys and they run away from Earth Eater. What's a better story than that?
That is very true. There's also, well, and I guess there's meet cute with Izzy and Cassandra, but they already know each other. But Tatter's whole role and kind of, I feel like he kind of is like a big statement on the second volume itself, what's going on with the journey that Taka's on. But if they ever do another volume, I would love to see more Tatter. Like, I would read a whole series just about Tatter and him boxing his weird manager that sells the photos of him getting beat up and other boxers losing.
Is it Tatter? Because I got a big chuckle and really enjoyed reading it as Tater. I thought he was Tater.
Tater?
Tater?
I mean, it could be. He gets mashed. You know?
He did.
I really liked him as Tater.
I think it's two T's.
I think there's that's two T's. Two T's, huh? I think you're right,
two T's.
But I suggest reading it as Tater. It's great.
No one loses like Tater.
What about the Unperfect? I think.
Oh yeah, we didn't touch on them from the first.
We left off talking about Volume One. Yeah,
I forgot all about those gnarly skin rippers.
I think it's wild to me just how much stuff happens in so few issues that we forgot about that major plot arc.
Which is a huge part of the first volume.
Just rewind a little bit.
Yeah, they're pretty interesting villains.
What are you guys' thoughts on those guys?
Like the... Oops, sorry, go ahead.
I was immediately reminded of Escape from L.A., and there's that scene where it's
just
Bruce
wild-eyed
Campbell,
crazy.
Like,
oh man,
assembling people. Yeah, but yeah, I thought that it was an interesting sort of foiled to everyone else's quest, where these people are not trying to unmake themselves, they are trying to make themselves perfect, lasting individuals.
In search of perfect symmetry, trying to find the like just the right pieces to make themselves match and be like beautiful, even though when we see them,
they look like fucked up Frankenstein. Yeah, I was gonna say,
I don't know how they're gonna hide all that stuff, but that's part of the beauty.
Yeah, we should mention that they're going and cutting people's quote unquote perfect body parts and like sewing them onto themselves.
And we're introduced to them in what has to be the worst Motel 6 stay ever. Like, imagine waking up to them.
Just opening you up. Ooh, no, thank you.
Well, I imagine that's what happens when you stay in some of those shady ass motels.
In Motel 6.
Yeah, those guys are. They were pretty wild. And I got to agree that there's a lot that happens in these first four issues that, like, I almost forgot about them, too, until Jack brought them up. But they form a pretty big crux of the backstory between Izzy and Polly and Cass, even.
Sandra, yeah.
But it's, yeah.
So this is sort of a large-scale thing with this book, kind of big picture, but, like, that's a testament to, like, there's a lot of violent acts in this, but they're never even necessarily the focus of their own pages, which I think is interesting. Like, that, when the big sort of raid against them happens, like, it's almost a side plot to the big picture themes. I think the biggest, and this one is, I'm verging on spoiler territory, but at the, towards the end of volume two, the sort of full circle with the police officer, which a perfect ending to that little arc. It's like a single panel that wraps up in, and not even a large panel on its page, which I think is a really interesting choice.
No, it's very small in that confrontation.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but it was so satisfying.
But like, it's a major. Yeah.
It is a major point though.
I don't think I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it takes some serious skill on the part of the entire team to pull off making something so impactful in the bottom right corner of your two page spread. Like,
really implying, like, it works though without showing it, but knowing how gnarly this world is like almost 10 times more effective. But yeah, that particular panel I was so grateful for. Like, the reading that whole part of the arc, I was just like, oh man, I know there's only one more issue left. I know there's not going to be another one after this for who knows, maybe forever. If this guy does not get what is coming to him, I'm going to be so mad at this world, this imbalanced world. But,
and I think what a like solid way to wrap up a thread. Like, that one confrontation tied together a lot of the like issues that all of these people deal with in this really messed up world that they're existing in. And it's such a simple act that like puts the period at the end of that sentence.
Exclamation point, even. Bang.
Yeah.
Nah, periods. Periods more appropriate. Like the Volkswagen ad. Period.
He's such the, he's like the embodiment of all police brutality too in this world. He's just, complete asshole.
Yeah. Okay, so if we're getting into the back into the second volume, have you guys read the book Snow Crash? It's like a 90s cyberpunk novel.
That's William Gibson, right?
Yeah. I think so. No, William Gibson is the Neuromancer series. So let me see.
I think Snow Crash is too, right? So. I don't think I've...
No,
I
it's someone I've else. I have it, I mean, like, ever on the bookshelf behind me. But I don't know where it is. Anyway, so in Coffin Bound, we see this they're injecting this.
It's Neal Stephenson.
Neal Stephenson, yeah. So we see in Coffin Bound, they're injecting the drug God, is what they call it. And who knows? Like, I don't know. There's a lot to that, I guess, but it reminds me a lot of in Snow Crash, kind of the whole premise is like the drug Snow Crash and like speaking in tongues and all this is like connecting to like the religious centers of your brain, because that's a thing in this, in that universe. It's like connecting to the religious parts of your brain and pretty much like hacking into your brain to control you, and they're like injecting this religion essentially that's brainwashing them. And I don't know, that I just got, that really reminded me of Snow Crash, the them injecting God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was Dan's like books. Oh really? Yeah, it sounds, yeah. I love Cyberpunk. Definitely wanna check that out then. I thought it was Dan's like literal translation of the old saying that the religion is the opiate for the masses, and it's like taking it a step further and doing it where they're literally shooting up God, which is probably heroin, but, or it's just God. We don't really know.
Well, that's, I kind of, if it kind of seems like heroin, but also heroin doesn't make you black out and speak to a
that weird that we know dude, of,
as far as I know. Yeah. So I thought at first it was probably heroin, but like seeing her go on her crazy trips where she like talks to the void, it makes me think there's, it's like some magical heroin like substance.
So I think there were a couple of things interesting about this. Number one, it did not demonize the people who were members of the church, which I thought was good and important. Like, no one was blamed for being a member of this and for seeking God in such a way, which I think is a very compassionate way to handle this sort of difficult subject. So kudos to the whole team for that. And also, I do think that it was a sort of amusing on how easy it is for individuals in tough spots to use religion as a crutch. In the same way that people might make that argument for drug usage. And I think it was a really interesting literal way to just, I mean, it's like, there's no subtext here. It's all text. It like religion is a drug in this world, which I think is an interesting way to handle what could be sort of a divisive opinion.
Yeah. I can imagine some people leaning taking on that God interpretation in the wrong way.
I mean, that's a communion, right? You're eating the flesh, you're drinking the blood.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's what they call it too when they go to shoot up God. Yeah.
Well, and then it's ready for, I was going to say, is or not, is he talking, has a literal communion with God at those times. She literally talks with whatever that embodiment is.
It's a true thing I've witnessed too. Like my friends that have had serious drug issues, like my buddy that I've known since I was a kid, he had serious heroin issues, got clean. And now he's like really a really diehard Christian. Like that's what all of his life is about now. So I mean, I've seen that transition literally happen from one thing to the other.
Okay, so there's called like a cross addiction where like people will be addicted to one substance and they'll quit it and become addicted to something else. And sometimes it's another substance, or sometimes it's like some people become shopaholics. A lot of people end up becoming religious addicts. And it's an actual like thing in addiction medicine. So they're like, religion is a dangerous addiction to go to from substance abuse.
If you're going
to
read the Bible, read it slow, okay? Don't get addicted to it. Just one book at a time, tops. Maybe two, because Genesis is a lot of lists. Exactly. So you got to get through that, and then you're in.
That's a whole conversation that I'm going to leave out of the podcast. But
I feel like that's just human behavior, though, is taking interest in when it becomes an addiction. I mean, I would say I'm addicted to comic books. It's a habit. I mean, I know it's a bad habit for you too, Chaz. Now we're bringing Jack.
It's pretty rough.
Habit full fold.
But it's the communion I love taking.
Last year, I love it too.
I enjoy it.
I wanted.
Before I found out I was having a kid, I would spend like $300 a week at Chaz's store. Yeah. Not anymore.
I want to pull it back, big picture, on the second arc real fast, because I liked that it almost mirrored. There's like a reverse of the direction of Izzy's story, in that she's trying to destroy herself this whole time to unlive. And then when we get to Taka, she's rebuilding herself. She's searching for more reasons to live. Well, she's searching for the vulture, and she knows that to do that, she needs to die or be close to dying. But I thought it was interesting that she's not actively searching. She's not seeking out her own destruction, as she was sort of in that first arc. She puts herself on the path to to that kind of thing, but I don't think that it's intended in the same way that Izzy was. Like, Izzy always knew this ends one way. That's it. For good or for ill, it only ends one way. And then in Taka, and especially in that 7 issue, we get to see that there's more than one way for it to end, and it's almost got that embrace of life instead of the rejection of it. That's kind of the feeling I got.
She doesn't seem to have any second thoughts about calling out her own, a hit on her own head, though.
Yeah.
She seemed to have just gone straight in. Spoiler. Full
spoiler warning. But,
is that a big spoiler?
I think she didn't show any immediate regrets, right? She was doing it.
Yeah.
But in a way, she's doing it for greater cause, right? I was
thinking about when she's actually given the choice, spoiler warning, but yeah. I feel like that's a great moral to like live, but never really truly felt life, or to die very soon and to have truly lived. I think that's a great thing for discussion too. And that having to make a choice like that, spoiler warning done. But I feel like that was probably my favorite part of the whole second volume. Issue 7 was just the black, white, and red issue, as we called it earlier. It's so trippy, and it's such a long but enjoyable read, and I feel like it really highlights Dan's own, and like Polly Starlight, Dan's own poetic telling of this story and kind of his meditative poem on death and living. And, you know, and I love Tatters saying, you know, pain, it makes you know you're alive and stuff like that, and kind of embracing it, because without experiencing pain, you don't really experience the joy in life. We were just talking about this between ourselves the other day. Without knowing sadness, you don't really know love. You have to have both experiences to really really go through life. You have to experience these things.
It also is the perfect antidote to Taka trying to use God, either in a literal sense or as the drug in the book. But anyway, trying to use God to escape pain and like not feel pain. And he's like, no, dude, feel pain, because that's what it is to be alive.
Yeah, like her whole, I think, before he tells her that, she's definitely one trying to avoid all pain and not try to feel the things she's gone through. And he's kind of tells her, you know, you got to feel it. Like I said, I love that Tatter. I would love seeing a whole volume of him just boxing and losing.
Tatter was the reverse vulture, in a way. You got, stay alive, yeah. So you could feel. You're probably going to die, so feel them.
Well, that's... I was just thinking about that same thing, where him being sort of like, we said that we missed the vulture in the second volume, but I think that Tatter fills a similar role, where these characters with interesting things to say, there is no outside of the, if I'm remembering correctly, outside of the introductions of the sort of antagonists, there is no real exposition in this. There aren't like caption panels. So we have main characters who always have someone to talk at that gives us that experience. Like, Izzy has the vulture and Taka has Tatter, and they have these like really heady, like intellectual conversations because there is this sort of passive character to bounce it off of. And I think that was a really like smart thing that Dan did in writing this, is having these characters who they're almost more lovable because they are around these people who are so bleak in certain ways. So the juxtaposition of like this sort of almost goofy vulture with Izzy, who is like so hyper focused on her mission, like it just works.
It really does. Yeah.
He's like a little bit. Yeah, he's got like a little bit of goofy, and she's like straight up full blown edgelord.
Yeah. Tatter man. His musings on life. Gotta give it to him. He takes a beating, but it didn't rattle his brain, thank goodness.
There's also this crazy blood clinic where you can go and get good blood from basically all types of different people, which is I found very interesting, that it's not by like the kind of person they are like genetically, it's by the kind of person they were, like their soul and emotionally how they lived their lives. Yep. Yeah,
it's very striking too, because that takes place in that 7th issue, that black, white, and red issue. So the stark contrast between the red bottles of blood, as he's describing, we got hot blood, we got cold blood, we got sinners, we got saints, we got anything you want to feel. Adrenaline, you got it. Melancholy from Unrequited Lovers, here you go. really like paints a picture because there's so much blood behind him.
Just from a process perspective, I cannot imagine how Danny and Brad Simpson worked on that issue together. Like, I do not know how it came together.
That's what I've been thinking about, too, with the visual storytelling and the, like, writing. They were just gel together so well.
Yeah, this is a great team.
I just, like, thinking about those panels, that you made that Spy versus Spy joke earlier, but, like, that's sort of spot on, and I don't know how... Like, I can't imagine what the script looks like for that issue.
Yeah, I'm super curious myself.
I would love
to read it. Yeah. What kind of notes are in there?
Because I want to know how much...
Yeah, it's like...
Emma's role, too, comes into it. Because she's the graphic designer for both volumes. So, I mean, I wonder if she designed a lot of the characters, too, with Dan. Because I know, she's been a part of the team, too. So I feel like they've had all... Like we're saying, it's all a team effort.
I will sing... I think that Brad Simpson is one of the best colorists in the game. There's like, I tend to follow creators more than I do like certain stories, and I will basically try any book he colors. I think I got onto that train. He did the Bloodborne book with Ailes Cott, and like video game adaptations are always hit or miss, but like that's a hit. Like that book is solid and it is gorgeous.
I've never read it. That's good to hear though. Yeah.
It's fantastic. It's really good.
Man.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about video game comics recently. I know Pat Nadell wrote the Assassin's Creed ones too, but I do that too. Like my thing is the White Noise Studio. Like anything those four guys write, no matter who it's for, whether it's DC or it's freaking Scout or it's Vault, I'll read it because pretty much all their stuff I've loved that's come out, no matter how weird and different it is, which Dan's a part of. And yeah, Dan, which is cool too, is how talented he is. I think he's the youngest of all of them. I'm pretty sure he's in his mid-20s, where the rest are probably more around my age. But he's so good. He reminds me so much of like the writers. Like why I love Dan Waters, he reminds me of why I fell in love with comics. Like as like a I liked him as a kid, but then I fell in love with them when I was like 13 or 14 and reading Vertigo. And they really capture that magic again. As Chaz said, this could have been released in 1994. It's hard to do it authentically. And not trying to like emulate the feeling. And Dan does it so authentically. Like, it's not like he's trying to write like Vertigo. He just is that kind of writing. And
I have not read his Lucifer
stuff.
It's
incredible.
Very good thing.
I'm obsessed with Mike Carey's run. So, I mean, like, I would be a hard critic because I love Mike Carey's Lucifer run. And that's how I fell in love with Dan Waters, is that came out and I was reading it. And by the third issue, I was like, this is the best Lucifer since Mike Carey. This is incredible. So then I went and read all of Dan's other stuff. And then Coffin Bound came out and I was like, this guy is one of the best writers out today. Like his Lucifer run is so good. I was so bummed because I got it from Chaz's store monthly. And then they say, you're not getting another issue until it comes out in trade February of next year, which is totally like,
we're almost there.
A month away. Yeah. I guess it just wasn't selling well. You would know more about that than me, Chaz, because Chaz is a manager at my local comic shop. So,
yeah, it was. It's tough with some of those titles. You know what I mean? They have a very dedicated group that loves them.
You got to be like me and probably grew up loving Sandman Universe and stuff like that. Like I love all that stuff. Spend way too much money on the omnibuses and stuff like that.
Well, I mean the cancellation of Hellboy.
It is a crime. That was one of my top books of the year. Such a good series. Another Cy Spurrier is actually someone we're gonna talk about soon here on the show. But my God, I mean, it's really sad it ended, but I will say, Brian, he ended it in such a way that I'm a diehard Hellblazer fan. I own so much Hellblazer that it sounds crazy. That might be my favorite Hellblazer run ever. I mean, because so many Hellblazer runs I would almost say are damaged by the fact they're too long. I mean, they have really great parts, but those 12 issues are perfect. Every single issue and the way it wraps up in that final panel of John kind of like, fuck you, is so John Constantine. And like the John Constantine I read as a kid, that is just like, it's hard to capture that Vertigo vibe. It's hard to like organically and authentically write John Constantine as he's supposed to be. But Cy and Aaron and Matthias and freaking Jordy, everyone on that book, it was alchemy as well. Perfect. It is a crime. And it was more of a crime as it sold really well, like the first three issues, I think. And then the sales just plummeted. And then they just announced the cancellation. They didn't even give it a chance, one thing I do not like about the big two, especially because I see this happen, is they don't give the book a chance to find its audience. where they, you know.
I don't follow a ton of Big Two stuff anymore, but that is one that I did buy. As soon as I like got on board with it, I tracked down every back issue and kept up with it monthly. Yeah. It was
so, so good. That's like pretty much all the stuff I read from Big Two is, for DC, it's Black Label or Sandman Universe, where someone's got a lot of, a little more freedom to do what they want to do. But I feel like all books, even Coffin Bound, like any comic book, if it's not coming out in trade, you got to give it at least, you know, 5 months to find its audience, maybe even more than that, because it's all about word of mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time they announce a cancellation, people like me and you were already raving about how good it was, but you didn't get us to rave to enough people. You got to get that first trade out first, because people are going to buy that trade if they weren't buying the single issue. And then if they love the trade, they might buy the next single issue. So
it's always the hope.
Yeah.
Cy also is another person that captures kind of, not even old school Vertigo. He just is, that whole volume reminds me of punk rock as well. Talking about punk rock volumes, that Hellblazer 12-issue run is very punk rock. Not getting too ahead of ourselves, but yeah, White Noise Studios is something I read all the guys' books pretty much. I mean, Dan and Ram love everything they kind of do, even if it's Big Two related. And then Alex and Ryan, I just am getting them to read Fearscape because that book is so crazy. I don't know if you've ever read it, but
I have it, but I've not read it yet.
It's good, but it's totally Ryan O'Sullivan's like prank on the audience, where he's just playing the storyteller and he's an unreliable narrator, and he's constantly talking to you, and just his kind of pointing out the things that happen in comics and in fan culture and all these things that happen, and the way he does it is the latest issue of Dark Interlude, which is great. Is the main character as a writer is kind of just, he has a great monologue in this scene without trying to spoil any of it, where he really talks about what's wrong with fandom today and how people treat creators, but doing it in a way that's not like aggressively saying it, but being very blunt about it. Because the writer's not a nice guy. The narrator of those two stories is the scummiest scumbag in the world. So so he's not nice about it, but it's like all these incidents he's talking about probably happen to creators all the time. And, you know, and it's a good way of being like, don't act this way.
Oh, man. There's one, not to swing it too far back. I don't want to whiplash anybody to talk about Coffin Bound real fast again, but we didn't talk about Madame Entropy.
Madame Entropy,
and I loved that she's reverse Earth Eater. Like, Earth Eater feels very proud of his captions. Like, there's no, I guess not proud. He doesn't actively destroy them like Madame Entropy does, which I think was pretty great. I think actually you kind of mentioned that it's like a joke on itself that the panels are screaming out to the audience, no, wait, she's going to do it again. And then she touches it and destroys it right after her own meta humor. Yeah.
It's stuck in the words right off the pages.
Yeah, I've got issue 6 here, and I think it might be the first time she pops up. And it said, Earth Eater, that isn't him, is it? It's like, yeah. Those took a hard pivot from, like, these sort of introductory captions to this fourth wall-breaking, like, fun.
Almost with an acknowledgement that all stories end. Like, that was Dan knowing, like, okay, I'm going to end it for now at this arc, so I need this character to come in and just, like, no matter what, things are ending. Because even on both sides of that issue 7, she's waiting at either door. Like, she's always going to be there, which was cool. And her look is neat. She's very much, we're talking 90s Vertigo, she's very much got that, like, cool vibe, wide shoulders. Like, you could, like, for me, I could hear her walk, like, that click, click, click of what I presume are high heels on any surface she's on. Like, even if it wouldn't have sounded, it would make a sound. but yeah, those big, wide shoulders and like, just the whole look of her was cool.
Her mouth was an interesting design.
Yeah.
It was kind of, I don't know, how would you describe her mouth?
I was just looking at it. At least the panel I'm looking at, they just look like black lips. How would you describe her mouth, Jack?
I don't know. In some of the scenes, it's like, kind of looks like a, like a hole in her face. I don't know. It's like
a negative space.
I don't even know how to describe it. It's like scribbled on and looks like it's just like ready to suck everything up.
I think her hair's different every time we see her too, which I've noticed. In the first time we see her very briefly in issue 5, it's like almost like a blue puff. And the second time you see her, it's more black and long. And then the last time we see her, she's got like a shortcut.
She's got like a bob or something. She's
constantly changing her look.
That's entropy, yeah. though. Can't mm-hmm. be satisfied with one haircut. Well, the first day after you get a haircut yeah. feels great. And then the next day, I try to style it myself, and I hate it. So, like, I'm immediately ready to get back in the chair. So, entropy on haircuts moves very fast.
Without spoiling it, if there is no more coffin bound, I'm so happy with that last page, which is Madame Entropy involved without giving it away. But that... It's really, to me, speaks on life because it's so sudden things that end and you don't really prepare for it. But unless you are actively preparing for it, which a character is doing in this series, but it just comes like that, all ends, you know what I mean? Just suddenly. And
yeah,
I think it's a good, I would almost be upset if Dan did more. I mean, I'd love more Coffin Mountain and be in this world more, but I also feel like so much of the statement of the second volume is all things end, and you don't know when they'll end, but they're gone when they're gone. But I guess in that same statement, you could say they can come back whenever, because you don't know really when they'll
end. Well, then all things pass on. The mantle, yeah. the helm, if you will, the bird mask of Izzy
yeah.
passes on to Taka, passes on to Dahl. Who knows who's going to carry that sort of weight next? So even though all things end, they all continue, right? There's Madame Entropy's always yeah. there because she has to be.
And that's a great point that you brought up, the mask kind of as a symbolization of who's our narrator or heroine. It passes between them.
Yeah. yeah. And I thought, too...
Almost being like the next person that finds the mask would be the damn protagonist of Volume 3 of Coffin Bound.
It's like the movie The Mask, but less zany. She just throws it off a bridge into a thing, and some guy finds it and puts it on, ready to start killing.
Stanley Ipkiss.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Yeah.
It's like The Mask.
It's like The Mask, but weirder.
It's like The Mask.
Put it on the books. Put it on the hardcover edition. Yeah. Chaz. It's like
Mask. If you thought him taking the mask off was going to involve taking his flesh off too, you'll love Coffin Bound, where they take the flesh clean off. Yeah.
Dan's looking for cool quotes.
I'm ready for a blurb on the back of the big hardcover. It's like The Mask, but not. I don't think that one's going to make it. No. Gotta word it a little tighter. Gotta workshop it, maybe. I enjoyed talking about this book a lot more with y'all. Just overall. Like, I enjoyed it a lot, being able to read all 8 issues at once. Because monthly, I wasn't as keen on it, I think. Like, I just had too many other books probably kicking around that I didn't devote enough of my brain space to remember in. Or at least just embracing the world as it came, instead of questioning what this meant, what that means, who those are, what sort of vibe is this. So this read, I just read... And I liked a lot more, and hearing what y'all thought about it has been really enjoyable too.
Yeah, it's great to talk about this book with anyone. I really enjoy Brian's take on the most punk rock book. It really does, or just counterculture. Me and Jack, I feel like you would probably. That's why I thought you were gonna love it so much, because so much of where Jack lives now, I used to live as well, and it's like a fully counterculture area. I mean, everyone that lives in that area where he lives is all counterculture. Except the people that aren't, but it's kind of
I'm sure there's an Earth Eater out here somewhere.
I am sure there's an Earth Eater.
If you can get a picture of him eating dirt, I want to know if it's as unsightly as it seems.
As it seems.
Michael, I bet Starlight Compost eats dirt sometimes.
I can't believe we forgot to bring her up during Ryan's... Did we?
Yeah, we did. We talked about her making, like...
The Turotsi...
Roadkill clothing.
It's pretty coffin bound. Yeah. Now that I think about it. Yeah, we should talk
Where
about
I
it.
I used
now.
To live in California. There's a lady there that runs a commune, and it's a natural school of learning, and she's kind of like this counterculture icon, but she like just strips in public. She puts dead animals on her body and like protests. I don't remember what she was protesting, but she did something where she got on Highway 49 and covered herself in blood wearing animal corpses. To protest something. I don't really remember what she was protesting, but she also actively like drinks Datura tea all the time. Like, and when we read North Bend, the first thing I thought to tell Ryan about was like, I know someone that's actively done Datura for like the last 25 years. And he was like, are they okay? And I was like,
no.
they're covering themselves with blood and skinning roadkill, so probably not.
They have naked sweat lodges every weekend.
They put compost in their name.
Hey, I can't believe you never gone to that.
Like,
I went. I attended one of the naked sweat lodges, and it was very uncomfortable. And me and Bronson were the only ones that wore clothes in the sweat lodge.
That's why it's uncomfortable.
We were both in the Bay Area.
It's a naked. Everybody's there naked, and you're wearing clothes? Come on. Of course, you're going to put the vibe off a little bit.
He was so pumped.
My family does sweat lodges, so I can just do it with them. Don't have to go to Starlight's crazy compound.
Too, I'm guessing.
I feel like, why are you doing a comic book podcast when you could be doing, like, investigating this commune?
There's too many of those nowadays, those true life investigative podcasts. So we went there.
We're going to set up a YouTube channel. I guess,
the kind of one thing that makes Starlight Compost make more sense is that her parents were, like, some of the original founders of the Rainbow Gathering.
And
had her like spun out on psychedelics as a kid and stuff.
So I heard
they gave her, I know that she openly said they would give her LSD when she was like four, which is not not good. I mean,
not at all, that's not ethical.
Just in case anyone listens to this and knows her, she's a very nice woman. I've had nothing but nice experiences with her. She's very strange, and it's strange to date her actively and not be like it forced on you just because of the very dangerous side effects of it, and you could die doing it, which is just strange for me to someone to consume that willingly so often. But she's definitely a strange one. We could get into investigative journalism in this. Jack, I'll come back and visit, and we'll sneak ourselves onto the sweat lodge and try to film it.
Don't try to film it. It's a nude sweat lodge. You got to get their consent for that kind of stuff first, man. Record it. Audio is fine. You never know if anybody's wearing clothes with audio. Well, when you're on video, you know, but otherwise you don't know.
It would also be pretty weird if we were wearing like those super obvious like secret camera glasses, totally naked in the sweat lodge.
Yeah. Are those fogging up on you guys? No, we're good. We'll just leave them on. I want to make sure I could see all the sweat in the lodge.
Totally.
Gotta get these visions clearly.
Okay, so where were we?
I still can't believe you've never gone to one of those. I thought that was like a thing everyone's done up there.
No, I avoid that compound. I've only been there once. That's actually what she calls it, is like her compound.
She calls it her compound, yeah. Oh, the person, this is someone I actively hung out with at the time, was always going to them, and they were like, you gotta go. And I was like, this is the normal thing to do. And now I find out, years later, it's not. Jack.
No, totally not. What is cool though is because she skins roadkill. She has all kinds of cool fucking like pelts all over her house, like bear skins and shit.
Her property is like outstanding. Like I don't know how wealthy she actually is, but I mean, literally,
I think it's her ex-husband or something.
And then there's four other houses. It's crazy.
It's like 12 acres. It's a compound. Like you don't just call something a compound. You gotta get it, you know? Yeah. I also can't believe that people still call their stuff compound. There's no good connotation of compound and a location anymore. Like, that's true, like, madman status of, like, I've got my compound now and my men. They're going to protect, they'll lay down their lives for me because I'm their prophet or whatever. Like,
I would love a compound.
Yeah. Really embrace this.
No, I don't think I could ever have property. You want to come to my compound? That just sounds.
Once you actively take people in,
I just imagine
like homeless
that
they're having issues. Like that's why so many people are living in her house. Like anyone that would come to her with either like having an issue or not having a home, she just let them live there and work on her compound. Which also, though, is how you get more people at your compound.
That's how you compound your compound.
It's true.
Into a cult.
That's how you turn your number from 20
to 100.
There must
be some conspiracy.
Yeah.
There must be like a vast underground layer. In the compound.
Always.
Okay, so anyway, we've been on this tangent for a long time.
Okay, let's go back.
Yeah, we've really painted a picture, I think, of that compound with sweat lodges and pelts everywhere. Like, I feel like it could have been a scene.
Now Brian's going to write a comic series about it.
It could have been a scene from Coffinbound, almost, in a way.
Oscar, if you're listening to the show for some reason, I know the sweat lodges are yours, and you're a great guy. I apologize for any.
Oh, they're all good people. Keep it sweaty, they're all good people.
They're all good people. Even
strange
even
people,
good
but
people.
Good people.
It's just strange.
So, what were we talking about?
Do you guys want to pull in into our final thoughts on Cough Mountain, and then kind of talk with Brian a little bit before we do the final wrap up?
Sure. I feel like I kind of dropped my final thoughts on Cough Mountain right before we journeyed into Starlight Compost territory.
Again, this is the second episode.
I'm gonna do my final thoughts real quick. To me, this book is very punk rock, and it's also a very beautiful and meditative experience. If you're a fan of old school Vertigo or just something unique that's not your common comic book, and you want to read something that's very individual in its own right and has humor, really different story and characters that you'll see nowhere else. Like, the design of these characters is really priceless. Dan and Danny and Emma and Brad and Aditya's, all their collaborative effort to create this really stands out. It's one of the best books I've read in the last few years. I got to agree with Brian on that one. And it's a book I'll remember 10 years from now and will be on my best of the decade of the last 10 years. Definitely. It's like Blue and Green. I know that both Blue and Green and Coffin Bound in 10 years, most likely, unless like really phenomenal things, which they do come out every year, come out. Those two are the white noise books. Really, maybe I'm just a white noise fanboy, which I am. I mean, I love all the stuff they do, but Coffin Mountain really hit me in a way a book hasn't in a long time and really brought me back. And it is a bit of nostalgia because it really brought me back to what made me go from comic book reader from like a five-year-old to comic book lover like 13 or 14, which was the Vertigo books. And that's what really was like, oh, wow, you could do so much with this writing medium, like this creative medium, which is something I love about comics because you don't even get it in movies anymore, which is I used to be a huge movie buff, but so much movies actually go to theater today are not original stories. And really in comics, we're blessed with these original, beautiful stories, which Coffin Mountain definitely is. So if you haven't read it, both trades are out now. You should definitely buy it. Either from, I would say, your LCS first, yeah. But if you don't have a local comic shop, they definitely got it on Amazon. Let's move on to Brian and Jack's final thoughts.
Yeah, final thoughts. Read this book. It is beautiful. It really is. I think that it is a piece of art that stands alone as an experience. Don't ask too many questions as you move through it. Just kind of let it happen to you. I think that's the best way to experience this story. The team is just like a cohesive unit that, like, every page is a work of art. Just enjoy.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is there to say that hasn't been said? I think you guys nailed it. Definitely 10 out of 10. Would read again.
Awesome. And Brian, we all know it was one of our first episodes. I know I'm going to be a bad man or now and forget. Your trade's coming out soon. What day does the trade come out?
It should be out. I think it's February 10th. Perfect. It's right around Valentine's Day. So get it for your loved ones. If you don't get it for your loved ones,
it's the perfect Valentine's
Day. Wow.
There's more content in it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So it'll be the first three issues and then at least two short comics.
Sweet.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got my money. That's
yeah.
Yeah. I want
that. Awesome. I love
content.
That world you created. Yeah, thank you for creating that world. It's really fun. And just, I mean, you probably heard us talk about it. It was really it's just a fun experience. And man, you created a character that is really memorable.
Yeah, I thanks so much. You guys had really nice things to say about it, and that's always very nice. It's a weird, tiny little indie book, so I super appreciate anyone taking the time to dig into it.
It was a great read.
Original stories, yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Do you have any insight for us that you want to lay out on the new issues?
Oh, gosh. So, new issues have been postponed for a while just because indie comics
Fair.
Money.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to slowly, you know, chip away at it and maybe do some one-shots, like, over the course of time. But, you know, comics are expensive, and I have other stuff that I want to make, so Kevin and I are not done working together, but Grid is going to be on the back burner for a little bit. But yeah, the next thing that we have planned, I'm actually doing with Simon Kirks. It's called The Ballad of the Bloom Knight. It's another collection of shorts, so that'll be three short comics about that character. I will, regardless of format, one of them will be coming out next year in some way, even if I just like put it online. Multiversity hosted a Storyforce before; they might do another one, something like that. But we'll have at least a trickle of great content.
I checked that out too on Multiversity. It looked cool. Yeah. It was weird seeing him drawn by someone else. It was a strange
thing. Yeah. There's another artist. So that story is in the trade. And then there's another one. It is called The Mutt. And it is a story about Barrow. And another very different artist, Dylan Snook, is doing it. And his style actually verges on... I don't like to compare folks, but there is a sort of like Danny level stuff at work.
Awesome.
It's a very different vibe, and then Simon Goff coloring it is incredible, and it's a very different sort of quiet story compared to everything bombastic that happens in Grit. So I'm really looking forward to people.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to read it. See another side of Barrow. That'll be awesome.
Yeah, it's all very exciting stuff.
It follows. It's four pages of Barrow taking a day off.
Yeah. Oh, dude, those are like my favorite episodes of like. Animes and shit, where you see like all the characters just kicking in, like see how their regular life goes.
It's a lot of fun. It's I will bring Simon with me on every book I do if I can, because his colors are
they're
just
incredible,
glorious.
Yeah.
And this story is another like beautiful.
Awesome, excited for it. Well, this has been an episode of Outside the Panels. Brian, thank you so much for coming on. We really are grateful for you coming on and talking about Coffin Bound. Where can people find you on social media?
I am at BM Wickman just about everywhere, Twitter, Instagram. Twitter I use mostly. But I'm always talking about upcoming stuff on there. Got a bunch of books in the works. So hopefully more stuff next year.
I'm excited for anything else that comes out from you. I'm Michael, but I'm on Twitter as PoetAir33. And then Chaz and Jack, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and most other social media as well under at Chaz Simons.
And you can find me at sin_aesthetics with an X on Twitter, or synesthetic on Instagram, which I am most active on. So.
And we'll be back with our Best Of episode of the year, and then we'll be diving into the White Noise Vault books and Ed Brubaker. Once again, Brian, thank you so much for being on. And you guys can all find the show at Outside the... with a zero. And thank you all for listening. This has been another episode of Outside the Panels. Have a great day. Be good to yourself. Be good to others. And
wash your hands.
Please wash your hands.
Cool. Is that a wrap?
Yep.